Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday. This is Cliff, your host, and welcome to Earth Ancients. I again have to apologize. Our last show was a weekday show, and a lot of people were asking me why the broadcast was on Tuesday. And I think I mentioned that our guest was calling in from Dublin, Ireland, and had a bandwidth issue. It was a great program. Bob Curran, the author of the Mythologies of Ancient World, was great. The book's great, and I definitely want to have him on again because we didn't get to enough of the content. The Lost Lands, Forgotten Realms is really a book that needs to be seen by more people because, as he described, a lot of these myths are actual legacies left by various people around the world. And so he just touched on a few of the myths that have been discovered. Of course, the famous Troy and some other South American locations were highlighted. So definitely listen to that. I mean, if you haven't had a chance to listen, go to the Facebook page, Earth Ancients, Startling New Discoveries from Our Planet's Distant Past, and have a listen. The other guest we had last week was Holly Amberg. I have not had a chance to put up all of her photographs, but she described the satellite view of the Atacama Desert in northern Brazil, and it is quite amazing, these new photographs that she has posted. And I actually put, I think, six up of Nuevo Albergues, New Albergues, which actually shows these terraces, these man-made terraces that really nobody has found except for this 81-year-old researcher, a true armchair archaeologist. So she's an amateur, of course, but wow. I mean, we're looking at huge plains of man-made retaining walls stacked beautifully, something that you would probably see in Peru, Inca, similar to the Inca, but this is a completely different part of South America that really hasn't been discovered yet officially. According to her, there will be some research excavations going on this late spring and early summer. So take a look at that and see what you think. Definitely man-made. And we're probably going to hear about it on CNN once somebody gets out there and starts really taking some really on-the-ground photographs and readings and things like that. So fascinating stuff. I want to mention a video that I produced about 3 years ago that I posted recently. It's called Mementos of Ancient Pilots and Astronauts from Earth's Forgotten Past. As you all know, I am not a supporter of the Ancient Alien series, simply because, and it doesn't mean I don't believe in aliens. It doesn't mean I don't believe that the Earth has been contacted and may be continually contacted, and ongoing contact going on from other world civilizations. But Ancient Aliens basically throws everything that isn't explainable by conventional science, anomalous features, anomalous buildings, megaliths, the pyramids even, as potential or alien in design and construction. And what I did a few years ago is create a short video of a number of artifacts that I found and I have in my own personal collection. And by the way, most of the pieces that I collected were not collected when I was in doing research in Central America. The Mexican government is extremely strict about taking artifacts and removing them without identifying them first. In fact, if they catch you with artifacts, it's almost an invitation for jail time. So most of my pieces have come from auctions and eBay, strangely enough. But this video that I created is filled with a number of these pieces that I discovered. And the most unique part of the video is that many of these figures are wearing breathing apparatuses, zero gravity suits, and helmets. In fact, almost each one of the items, the figurines, is wearing some form of a suit or helmet. Mementos of Ancient Pilots and Astronauts from Earth's Forgotten Past. I published it, like I said, 2 years ago. I put it up. I really think you should take a look at it because all of the figures are from Central America, a couple from South America, and there's no way to explain away the interpretation that these artisans have made of what was at some point a space program, for lack of a better word. How close it comes to NASA, we don't know. Obviously, these are pre-Diluvian or prehistoric figurines. They're most of them are found in burial sites, deep, many hundreds of feet underground, in some cases. And I don't go into the specific locations of these figurines, but they're very unique. And I really would like as many people to take a look at it as possible because it's only good. The beauty of Facebook is that it gets it out there quick, but as more things are posted, it's pushed down and you kind of lose the freshness of it. I did mention a few weeks ago that I am in the process of putting up a website, Earth Ancient, Startling New Discoveries from Our Planet's Distant Past. But it is not going to be released now till like the early summer. But that site, when it is released, will have archives, my own personal archives, those of other researchers and authors that are featured on Earth Ancients, and you know, weekly updates and information. So do check that out. And as always, the Facebook page is your best resource for weekly information. Updates on discoveries and references to the authors and the speakers and the investigators that I have on the show. I have mentioned a number of times that in the 90s I was the program director for a program called Whole Life Expo, and at that time, let's say 1995, which is like the second year I was there, I opened and developed a ancient civilization, unknown worlds, and lost civilizations and anomalous discoveries branch of a speaking program, and invited people like Graham Hancock, Zachariah Sitchin, and a number of at that time up and coming authors. I got to know Zach Sitchin fairly well, and his books amazed me. Of course, we're talking, his books were The 12th Planet, and he wrote The Earth Chronicles, where he discusses the Anunnaki with a great deal of detail, and basically blew the doors open to, you know, aliens on Earth, aliens populating, genetically creating mankind, which many feel is us, are us. Since he wrote those books, and of course he passed away in 2010, a lot of people have said that his interpretations were wrong, his understanding of Genesis, his interpretation of the Bible and Hebrew doctrines and texts was misplaced. I tend to think that that's just jealousy. We have no way of knowing just how accurate his interpretations are, but there are people that understand cuneiform and other forms of Sumerian texts that say that maybe he bent the truth a little bit. But since Sitchin's books have been out, there have been a number of other authors who have come along. We've had a few of them. Michael Tellinger's book on slave species of the gods, which was quite interesting. We had him on the program. Of course, Michael has also written another book on the actual ruins of he feels are the Anunnaki, which is fascinating. And we had Sasha Listen on, who wrote a book called Anunnaki Gods No More, who discusses the Anunnaki. But we haven't really talked about the Nephilim. And my guest today has quite an interesting background and is going to present to us a look at just who these beings were. And my curiosity is if they're still around. If we are the creation of gods, are those so-called watchers and Nephilim still hanging around, keeping an eye on things? Maybe maybe they're the UFOs that we see. It's hard to really know. My guest today is Scott Roberts, and Scott is the founder and executive editor director of Intrepid Magazine, a journal dedicated to politics, science, and unexplained phenomenon. He has a radio show, and I didn't know that he was at one time the editor-in-chief of Sci-Fi's Ghost Hunter magazine, which is kind of interesting. What Scott brings to the plate is very, very unique, because he attended Bible college and theological seminary before deciding that was not his calling, and became an executive in advertising in the publishing world. But this book is very, very interesting. It came out a couple of years ago. The book's called The Rise and Fall of the Nephilim, The Untold Story of Fallen Angels, Giants on the Earth, and Their Extraterrestrial Origin. Scott, welcome to the program.
Hey, Cliff. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So your background is unique. You look at this work, the Nephilim and Anunnaki, from kind of a religious perspective. Was Sitchin an influence of yours when you started doing your research?
No, Sitchin wasn't at all. As a matter of fact, I'd heard actually very little about him before I read and started researching for my own book. Most of that is because I just wasn't exposed to that kind of stuff. And I didn't realize how much work had been done on the Nephilim and the Anunnaki and things like that and reptilians and all of that until after I started really researching for the book. It's different to say I've been studying something for 25 years and pulling up information on it than it is actually sitting down after you've been contracted to write the book and researching for it in that respect. So talking about it, writing bits and pieces about it, an article here and there, wasn't the same as actually putting a book together. So it was then when I had heard Sitchin's name and I wasn't all that familiar with his work, and I started looking into it. So he really wasn't an influence other than perhaps a negative influence in some senses, because I kind of took him to task on his linguistics. I said, he might be onto something here. We don't know for sure. None of us were there. None of us really knows. But right. I had a problem with the way he used his linguistics, and the way his scholarly work on his linguistics was really rough. And now I'm not a linguist, so I hail to other linguists when I'm looking at ancient languages. And Sitchin was somebody that came up several times in my research as somebody who simply didn't misinterpret. He just didn't grasp the full meaning of the word in their original form. Even further, the cases where there was ancient Mesopotamian language, cuneiform text that got translations of, he missed the fact that those ancient Mesopotamians also had a lexicon that was several thousand years accompanying these cuneiform texts, showing what certain words meant in different languages of the region. Different linguistic uses. And he missed that. He either missed it or he ignored it. And he simply misinterpreted things. I'll give you one example. The word mu, M-U, is a word that's found in the Mesopotamian records referring to the conical shape of the sky above the heavens filled with stars. It's the moon is where the stars were. The moon is where the sun is. The moon is where the moon and the rain is. And Sitchin interpreted that word to mean when the Anunnaki were coming down from the moon, the heavens. He wrote that the conical aspect of the word obviously matched the conical shape of the rocket nose cone, as we know them back when he was writing, especially the nuts and bolts of rockets. So he interpreted that as in clinical nose shape rockets from heaven. And I said, well, wait a minute, adding rocket to that word is a very different connotation. I think he have to keep that category the same. His research, his own desire to make a square peg fit into a time here.
Mm-hmm. So as a theological student, did you run across the references in the Genesis? Obviously you must have. And was this one of those areas that you began to question the biblical interpretation of these beings? And that was like kind of like the beginning of your discontent with your studies?
Yes. Well, that's exactly it. And it wasn't so much a biblical interpretation. It was, when I was in seminary, I went to a very conservative Baptist fundamentalist evangelical Christian school and seminary. And we were always taught that language meant something. If I had a dime for every time I was growing up and I heard, now let's see what Paul said in the original Greek, that's what we did. We went back to language. We were taught that language meant something. And so when you go to the language of Genesis 6, where it talks about the Nephilim, it talks about, and the sons of God came down and intermingled with the daughters of men and had children by them, and the Nephilim were on the earth in those days. And if you go and you look into the language of what Nephilim meant, you've got an idea of who they were. You got an idea of who the sons of God were, who the daughters of men were, just basically by the language itself. And what I started to question early on was, I would ask, well, who are these guys? Who are the sons of God that came down and intermingled with the daughters of men? And I was told in the circles I was in that, well, that's obviously the sons of the aristocrats who built the school of the prophets. And these students, if you were of the school of the prophets, went down slumming in the valley amongst the common women. And that was their offspring. It has nothing to do with anything angelic or anything mysterious or anything like that. And so I would ask a question, I would probe further. And I said, well, now, in the original language, the sons of God is rendered in the English is actually in the Hebrew, the B'nai HaElohim. I said, the sons of are those of the Elohim. And I said, who is Elohim? Elohim was the name used almost 3,000 times in the Old Testament for the name of God. And it was a singular word and a plural word, depending on its context in a sentence. So I said, these are characters that are the sons of God, are these sons or those of the Elohim. And I said, who are the Elohim? And I said, in the language, it also states the daughters of men. And I don't remember off the top of my head the Hebrew word for daughters, but it was the daughters in the Hebrew of Adam, of men. And I said, so you've got a contrast there in original language. You've got Elohim versus men. And I said, or Adam. And I said, so why is the contrast there? You taught us language meant something. Why is there a contrast? If it was just human men coming down to human women, why didn't it say the sons of Adam came and intermingled with the daughters of Adam? And so that was one of the big first questions I had about this type of thing. And that was, I mean, you're talking back in the early 80s. And so it was one of the first nails in the coffin for me to really separate myself from that train of thought.
Do you think the religious look at these ancient scriptures, the Bible, the Hebrew Bible, and other religious texts, tend to gloss these phenomenal beings over a little bit, and it's just they, because of the casualness of the look and the discussion, they gloss over these important figures in history? Or what is your interpretation as somebody who's researched these biblical texts?
I see them as being just another biblical story. Now, whether you have faith that that story is true as written in the Bible, if you're a Christian or if you're Jewish, you're going to take the Old Testament and say this is the Word of God. Now, of course, you have every brand of Christian or Jew out there, from Orthodox to Reformed to
right.
Liberal to whatever. So your interpretation of those are going to be really measured by your stance, if you will, politically within your religious beliefs. And so if you're a little more liberal thinking, you might think this is all mythology. If you're very conservative, you're saying in your orthodoxy, you're going to say these are all true stories. So when you look at it, we don't know. Well, number one, let's get to the basics of the here and the now. We have no idea that Nephilim ever existed as we think they exist. These are interpretations. These are stories. These are mythological accounts that we have brought up in the modern mythology. So we don't really know. We don't really know what's out in the galaxy beyond us. There are things we just don't know. We can say, well, we know there are planets. We know there's galaxies out there. But there's things we just don't know beyond certain points. There are veils we cannot pierce. We know that these characters were written of in the Bible, but we also have talking donkeys in the Bible. We also have all kinds of stories. We have the parting of the Red Sea in the Bible. And these are all stories that we easily, by faith in Sunday school and church or synagogue, we accept that these are true. But if somebody puts you in front of the Red Sea and you're standing there looking at it and say, now, do you believe that the waters parted? And you'd say, if I'm very orthodox, I'm going to say God has the power to do anything. So, yes. If I'm more liberal in my approach, just meaning more encompassing of other ideas, then I would say perhaps it was an earthquake, perhaps it was a natural disaster, perhaps, and all these perhapses then would have to fit into perfect timing when Moses and the children of Israel were standing there. So
exactly.
You have to look at that and say it was either a miracle, a miraculous event, or it was a miraculous event based on a natural event, And everybody just happened to be at the right place at the right time. Or it's something that did happen in that sense, and it's been built into legend, and over the years, the legend became religious mythology. So same with the Nephilim. We don't know for sure if they ever existed. We have lots of people that will compare them to things they experience nowadays, and there's been lots and lots and lots written on this. And as Solomon once said in the Proverbs, of the making of men's books, there is no end, and much study is a weariness to the flesh. And, you know, they have to agree. There's so much written about this, and yet when you boil it all down, it boils down to just a few basic facts and whether or not you choose to believe that it exists.
Well, your book is a fascinating look at the Nephilim, and I want to talk about it right away. It's such a great look. You attempt to dissect this ancient talk. You have a wonderful chapter. It's called "Who's Your Daddy?" From Elohim to Nephilim.
Elohim to Nephilim. Yes.
Yeah, which is interesting. And you source the Bible for details of the Nephilim. What did you discover in that early chapter? Can you tell us a little bit about the early uncovering that you have, and sure, some of the meat of what you interpret?
Sure. Well, what I found was that there was a linkage between the sons of God and the Elohim, as mentioned in the scripture. There was, and now keep in mind, as I just stated, you can believe in this stuff intrinsically because of your faith. But what I wanted to do was examine the mythology, the religious mythology itself. And I put it in that box because I wanted people to understand I'm going to step out of the box of religion and faith and look back at it, but I'm going to discuss it. I'm going to discuss the story as it appears. So that's how I do this. So I say, when you're looking at this, the first thing I noticed was that the Nephilim are merely the offspring. They're not the ones who did the impregnating and things like that you find in the verse before it. It says, the sons of God came down and intermingled with the daughters of men. And when I started looking at that verse, I thought, sons of God, the B'nai HaElohim, I thought, Elohim, I know, is a name for God. I found it's used over 2,700 times in the Old Testament as a name, a descriptive name for God. But then there's a passage in the book of Psalms. Now, if you write this down, if you want to go look it up, Psalm 82 talks about an event where God is standing with a group referred to as the Divine Council, and he's passing judgment on them for something they've done. But it's unspoken in the passage. It doesn't tell why, it just says he's judging them and cursing them in a way. And yet in the English it says, and God stood in the midst of the gods and said to them, you are all gods, the bright shining princes of heaven. But, and then he goes into his judgment. Now in the Hebrew it says, and Elohim stood in the midst of the Elohim, and he said to them, singular to plural, you are all Elohim, the same word that he uses for himself, only in the plural, the plural nature of the word. And so what you've got here is a group of Elohim, and one of them is the chief of them, and that is the person we refer to as God. So it seemed to me, now I might have a rabbi tear me to shreds on this one, but it seems to me that the Old Testament scriptures aren't as monotheistic as we would like to believe. That there are hints in the Old Testament scriptures that there were a multitude of gods that were worshipped by these ancients. Much like, and I found the Elohim is much like the Olympians, where you had all these gods, and there was one god that was greater, that was kind of the boss, and that was Zeus. And so I think the same thing is being found in the Hebrew scripture. And now, I could get into a debate with a rabbi, and he would probably say, no, you've got to look at this, and you've got to look at that. And, you know, I haven't had an opportunity to ever really be in that kind of a conversation. But what I found in Scripture is that the Elohim in Psalm 82 are the same as the Elohim in Genesis 6. That these are, and also the same as the serpent character in the Genesis story of the Garden of Eden. That We all learned in the Garden of Eden story that Eve was tempted by the serpent, beguiled her, and she ate the piece of fruit and gave it to Adam, and of course they were both naked. Mankind fell. God came down and curses them all. Well, we've always attributed that serpent in that story to be Satan or the devil or Lucifer or something like that. Yet in the text itself, it never uses any of those names or titles for the serpent. And the attribution of Satan or Lucifer or the devil does come from almost 1,000 years later when somebody, one of the prophets, writes that old serpent, the devil. And in the passage itself, he's named Nakash. And Nakash, the serpent in the garden, is a serpent character. It's almost an, a story, it's almost an analogy. And he is the serpent character. The definition of the word Nakash is bringer of knowledge, a bright shining one, the maker of mischief, the bringer of chaos. And by the way, chaos, the way we think of it in the connotations today, that he's evil, but the bringer of chaos was somebody who upturned the world. He turned things upside down. Changed things. And so what you're getting, at least according to Gnosticism, you're getting a view of one of the Elohim. Because if you go to the Elohim again in Psalm 82, they were the bright shining princes of heaven. Then you go back to Nakash in the Garden of Eden, the serpent character. He was the bright shining one. He's the one, the bringer of knowledge, which, by the way, corresponds with all kinds of other religions' creation stories. It was a character, usually in a serpentine form or with a serpentine aspect, that was the bringer of forbidden knowledge. And so this is the character we're talking about, and the same characters then appear in Genesis 6, the sons of God, the sons of Elohim.
Right.
And these are the same characters you find across, and that these are the ones who came down. And you don't see any. And the interesting thing I found is it's covered in 4 verses in the book of Genesis. And it's almost like the author of Genesis, who I believe was Moses, but it was definitely rewritten in the 400s after the Babylonian captivity. 70 rabbis went to the Library of Alexandria under the permission of Ptolemy II, and they recompiled the Hebrew scriptures. And in Greek, what's known as the Septuagint, which is basically the Old Testament today. But they went and they recompiled this.
Yeah. I'm curious, though, did you find, and we're going to talk about Moses in a minute, other than Moses, did you find any identifiable figures in the Old Testament that were, could be related to the Nephilim, an individual who had Nephilim qualities?
Sure. Sure, there were a few of them. One of the most obvious, of course, is Goliath, the whole story of David and Goliath. And as a matter of fact, the Bible, and a lot of people don't know this, the passage tells us that Goliath had 3 brothers, and they were all from Gath, and they were all children of the Nephilim, and as it states. And so these were, now they were giants in the sense that Goliath measured 6 cubits in a span, which was roughly, depending on the size of your cubit, because it was the measurement of a man's elbow to his fingertip, so it depends on how tall you were, roughly 9 foot to 9.5 feet tall, this Goliath character. And now we don't know if that was him from naked head to toe or him also with the Philistine headdress on, which had a tall plumed helmet on and so on. We don't know that for sure, just that that's the height. He was a big guy and a big warrior. And it says David also, after that scene where he, you know, the sling and knocks Goliath silly and then cuts his head off with his sword. It says that during that ensuing 13 years before David is king, he went and hunted down the other 3 brothers of Goliath and killed them all. There's this Og, the king of Og, the king of Og, the king of Bashan, I think, or something like that, that they found this huge bed. And they said his bed was like 9 feet long or something like that. And but it doesn't tell us exactly how big he was, but they were making reference to this king. And I asked the question, I said, does that mean the king was a big guy or the king was maybe 4 foot 8 but just loved a huge bed because he brought his harem in there with him? Who knows? We don't know exactly.
Yeah.
Because there's no quotation. But that's a verse. It's things like that that people just go off on.
Yeah.
But they don't exactly. They don't know anything about the guy. So there's interesting characters like that throughout the scriptures. And there's very few, but they're there.
Do you find that the references to various giants, giant races, that we've had a number of authors on our program who speak of giants who lived in the Americas, and there's references to giants in Europe and the Soviet Eastern Bloc area. Do you find that they, do you feel that, that those could be references to Nephilim also, or perhaps just a race of humans that were just huge?
You know, I don't know for sure. The problem is this. There is no real evidence. And the evidence you have, even like Caracas skulls and things like that, I know people who've seen these things up close, have handled them, have worked with them, and they're really just anomalies. They aren't congruent with a race of skeletons. If there's a race of them, why are we only finding one or two or three of them or something like that? So there's been DNA things done on some of these skulls down there, which is fairly farcical. I don't know all the information on that, but I have talked to the people who were intimately involved with that, and it's pretty much a farce. The finding of giant skeletons everywhere, you get stories from everywhere. Are there giant skeletons? Are there anomalous skeletal remains that have been found? Sure. Is the Smithsonian responsible for covering it all up in America? Who knows? What I can tell you is this. It's like this. It's like talking to a skeptic. A skeptic who doesn't believe in ghosts, doesn't believe in that anything of the supernatural nature. But I've talked to decent skeptics who will say, you know, it's not that we don't believe there's a possibility they exist. It's that we don't accept the evidence that's been presented. They said, we would love to see the real evidence. I had a well-known crusading atheist scientist, P.Z. Myers, who was part of the TED organization and a very much a crusading atheist out there. He teaches evolutionary biology at the University of Minnesota in out by Fargo, Moorhead. And he said, I would love for there to be aliens. He says, what a cool thing that would be. He said, I'm not against the idea. He says, I'm against the notion of all these crackpots that bring up weird BS about it. He says, give me something real. And people say, why don't you go research? He says, I don't have time. I research my own stuff. And he says, if you're researching that, give me something viable. Give me something real. And now, he's a bit of an ass. Anyway, but when he spoke at our Paradigm Symposium, I invited him to speak, and some people even booed him at the beginning and said, everybody said, knock that off. We are here to hear what the man has to say. Treat him as anybody else. And he gave a very good presentation. So this is what we're dealing with, I think, with the skeletons that have been found, the skeletal remains. Nobody really knows. It's always wrapped in some enigma. There's always something that's unprovable. It's like Bigfoot pictures. You know, I have yet to see a clear shot of a real Bigfoot. It's like UFOs. We have yet to see really good footage of a UFO that you can definitely parse down and say, this is real. Doesn't mean I don't believe it or I don't want it to be so. It doesn't mean it wouldn't be damned intriguing to know that there was a race of giants on this planet. But with all the evidences we have, we don't have real evidence that really establishes that. We've got a couple of anomalies, and if they were a race, you're going to find more than one. And you're not going to find one here, and then there's nothing else. And I rather doubt that the Smithsonian is engaged in covering them up. But I have a twofold opinion on that. Number one, academia and the utilizing the – well, when in regard to the nomenclature – of science today, academia is very selfish and very self-centered about that. They don't like to be the people who put forward theories don't like to be contradicted, and I get that. So is it a big conspiracy theory of all these people who don't want anybody to know there was a giant race? Or, as I've heard Smithsonian and I couldn't cite you the name off the top of my head, but Smithsonian representatives say, if there was an ancient race of giants, do you not think the Smithsonian would be behind that effort to find them? And they said,
yes,
that we wouldn't be burying them in our archives. There's not a reason for it. Unless, now let's step over here, you abide by the whole the whole notion that there's like this race of beyond the Illuminati reptilian types that govern our planet, and they're hiding these things. You know,
exactly.
You have to get into the superfluous ridiculousness to go there. Now, that doesn't mean I personally am somebody who doesn't believe some of this stuff exists. It means I have no proof for it. It's like God. I have no proof that God exists.
I also know a number of archaeologists, and the truth of the matter is there's just no money. They're so poorly funded.
That's
that to do the research into these areas, they are curious, and they do have to abide by certain standards. But the bottom line is there's just no money to do these research.
Like what they refer to as the Chinese Roswell. I was talking to Philip Coppens before his death about he was talking to me about the Chinese Roswell. And he said the problem is that there is no funding to support these kinds of archaeological projects. And so, and this is a terrible problem. I've even got good friends of mine, John Ward and his wife Maria Nilsson, who have the quarries of Gebel El Silsila south of Luxor. That's their archaeological site. But they're constantly in fundraising mode trying to find, and it's very quiet.
Yes.
They're not out there like, hey, call 1-800 to donate to. You know, it's nothing like
right.
that. They're constantly submitting universities and different organizations that fund these kind of projects. It's because the money is weak, even in just straightforward scientific, historical, anthropological, archaeological sites. You start putting aliens into that mix, and you're going to lose. You're way at the bottom of the line.
You're going to lose a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know, I want to talk about a central character in your book, The Rise and Fall of the Nephilim. You go into great detail about Moses, his work, his interaction with the Egyptians. You actually state Moses was the product of an 18th dynasty, Egypt. And it looks like you're actually claiming that Moses, according to your research, was a Nephilim. How did you come to that conclusion?
I don't think I ever said he was a Nephilim.
I thought it says like, okay, well, tell me my interpretation is wrong then. How does he work with that?
Well, the only reason I had a chapter in the Nephilim book about Moses was I wanted to say, why would Moses have written about the Nephilim? Since he did, let's explore a little bit about Moses, who Moses is and what he brought to the table. And so that's where I put it. My publisher actually wanted me to drop that chapter because he thought it didn't work. It didn't fit in the book. And I said, I have to disagree with you. I think it does. It establishes background. Now, Moses wrote about the Nephilim, and I wanted to find out why. And I said, let's start by finding out who he was. And I believe he's a real historical character. Just because there's a lot of religious legend built out about a man and it's become religious mythology, does that mean he didn't exist as a real person? Or, as we've come to know, most mythology has at its core, at its headwaters, some kernel of truth. And so, same with Moses. I looked into that, and I really established who I believe Moses was, how I believe the dating system lined up from biblical dating system, which I believe is, just because it's a book of faith doesn't mean it is not a book of accurate history. You can take accurate history and wrap a faith story around it, and you can go, well, the history is okay, even though I don't believe the faith particularly of the people who wrote that down. And there's been so much biblical archaeology done over the last 150 years. There are so many things in the Old Testament that have been verified to be accurate and spot on that it's really hard to look at the Old Testament and say, it's a faith book. Yeah, it's a faith book, but it's got efficacious history in it as well. And so I wanted to look at it from that standpoint, and I looked at the dating system, and I compared it to the chronology of the kings and so on and that, and it just seemed to me that it pointed out a certain man. And this man would have been a grand vizier in Egypt's day. I believe he was a man named Senenmut. And he was a grand vizier. He had 92 royal titles put on him. And he had the title of hereditary crown prince of Egypt placed on him by Hatshepsut, the female pharaoh.
Right.
But he also had been given his name by Hatshepsut. Senenmut meant mother's brother. I, your mother, am elevating you to the status of brother to the gods. So I went in and I wrote all about this character and what he would have experienced the first 40 years of his life as an hereditary crown prince of Egypt. And the schooling he would have had, the education, the religious training, all of this, the military training. And then you put that after he left Egypt, he's out in the wilderness for 40 years in Midian and Cush and all these places, and he's gained all the different religious stories from them. Mesopotamia, Canaanites, Cushites, all of these places he mingled in, and when he wrote these stories in the Old Testament, he included a hell of a lot of information from all these other cultures. And even the story of the Nephilim, the sons of God, which coming down, intermingling women, bequeathing the Nephilim, that four verses has earmarks of having been lifted from somewhere else and placed in there. It's an incomplete story. It was either somebody added that, or it was as if he was writing, like when you write a term paper for school and you write it on the Gettysburg Address, and you quote little snippets from the Gettysburg Address and make comments about it. And it's really, the passage on the Nephilim is also very neutral. It's not calling useful or bad or good or anything. It's just saying this happened. And it's linked to the preamble of the flood story, meaning the flood was part of the story. And so, linked to the book of Enoch, and you get the same events only spread out from four verses to 11 chapters. And it seems that what Moses wrote, and in Genesis, is excerpts for a highlight, if you will, the cliff-noted version of what you find in the book of Enoch, where sons of God are referred to as the watchers, and the Nephilim are there, so on. So, very interesting story. This is why I called out Moses. I didn't ever think it was a Nephilim. I said that, but I do believe Cain, the first child of Esau, was a Nephilim. And I believe that it was Nakosh, the father.
So maybe my misinterpretation is that Moses wrote, according to you, the law of the Hebrews, but he must have, are you saying that he had interaction with Nephilim, or they were maybe some documents he discovered that he really liked and took some of those interpretations or goings and happenings of the Nephilim and incorporated in some documents? How does he interact, or how does he get that information?
Well, here, first of all, I think that Moses did what Muhammad did with Islam. They both created religion, codified religions, out of whole cloth, based on bits and pieces of everything else. Moses, for example, he has all this different training, and he's got the Israelite slaves that he leads out. And there's even controversy about that, because there's no record, they say, of Egypt. And I want to know if the Egyptians really talked about, I would like to ask those people who say that, what other slave culture, suppressed culture, did the Egyptians write about? None of them. They're all mentioned. The Asiatics were these people. They were the peoples who for 800 years had been streaming into the Delta region, and the Israelite clan was just one of them, one of the family clans that came in to the Egyptians. They were nobody special, so they're not called out. And what pharaoh is going to put on the sides of his temples or his palaces inscriptions saying, yeah, and my slave race kicked my ass? None of them. And so the stories are pretty lean, but I believe Moses, with all the education he had, what he did when he led these people out was he was creating a nation, and he was nation building with these people, and he had to find a way to codify their ancient beliefs. And this is where Judaism came from. Remember, these people in bondage were not Jews per se, because Judaism didn't exist yet. They were pre-Jewish culture. They were Hebraic culture. They were a Canaanite Bedouin family clan of called Israelites because of their father, their patriarch, Israel, who was also named Jacob. And so this is where they came from. And so what Moses did was he codified religion for them. But he pulls in aspects from many other stories, many other religions. I think it's very evident that he has borrowed the Mesopotamian story of the Anunnaki and Elil and Enki and all these gods and the things they did and Atrahasis the king and the winning of the freedom and the forbidden knowledge of the gods and all of this stuff, has incorporated that into the Genesis stories of creation. And it's very obvious when you get into it and start looking at the comparisons. Just one comparison alone, Enlil, the chief god, also Elil, is the same name 1,500 to 2,000 years later, that as man and religion migrated down in from the Fertile Crescent down into the Canaanite region, in the Canaanite culture and eventually the Hebrew culture, the word Elil eventually became El. It was shortened to the El for God, which became Elohim, El Shaddai, El Elyon, names like that. The same with Enki. Enki in the Sumerian culture was also known as Iyah in the Akkadian culture, next door, so to speak, down the Euphrates River, these city-states. And they, 1,500 years later, Enki Iyah became known as Yahweh in the Hebrew culture, which is the Hebrew word for Jehovah. And so there's this moving of religion down through time. And I think Moses just borrowed a lot of these things. If you look at all the different things about the Hebrew religion, the Jewish religion that he established, the Ark of the Covenant was an Egyptian bark shrine. They're all over the walls of temples and tombs down there in Egypt. You have the Tabernacle of the Covenant, which was the tented version of what would eventually be the temple built by Solomon in Israel. And this tabernacle was laid out exactly like an Egyptian temple, with the holy place, the holy of holies, and so on and so forth. And there's a lot of codified things. That, as a matter of fact, the Ten Commandments are almost a reread of the admonitions, and which you can find in Egyptian culture. And
you
so
know, it,
all of,
yeah. Yeah. Go ahead. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, all of this is stuff that shows me that Moses built Judaism out of whole cloth to govern a nation of people. And there's a lot of other information on this. It's going so.
There's a lot of people that believe that Moses, or the character of Moses, had access to advanced technology. The Ark of the Covenant was a computer, a communications
yeah.
device, and there's a lot of speculation on advanced technology, which is interpreted by present-day scholars, thinking about our own computer society. Is it possible that the Nephilim did influence or did provide Moses with any devices, or do you have any references of noted individuals who could have been influenced by the Nephilim getting advanced technology?
In those times?
Yeah.
Or down through history, you mean?
Well, during the period of Moses.
No, my simple answer is no to that. Now, anything's
okay.
possible because we weren't there. All we
right.
know, according to the story, is Moses went up into the mountain for 40 days to commune with God.
Right.
And when he came back, the people were worshiping an idol of, by the way, an Egyptian god, Hathor, the golden calf. And they were at the mountain, I believe, Serebet el-Khadim, which John and I went to when we were writing the book. We climbed to the top of Serebet el-Khadim, and there's a big temple in ruins, of course, over thousands of years. The Temple of Hathor is there. This is where I believe the Israelites were camped, and they built an idol to the god whose temple was at the top, Hathor. And no, I don't believe that that Moses got special technical information from the Nephilim. I believe the Ark of the Covenant was simply another bark shrine. And the only thing, according to the faith story, that made it powerful was the presence of God dwelling in it. As a matter of fact, you know, if people touched it, they would die. But that was supposed to be, in the story, a part of the holiness of it. I believe it was just a box. It was a box that, according to the scripture, was built out of shittim wood and overlaid with gold. Now, you could build a box to those exact dimensions and overlay it with gold, some people said, and it became a transformer. You know, I don't think that happened, and I don't think that still happens. I could build a replica of the Ark of the Covenant. But one of the things we don't know is we don't know how the angels were positioned over the top. We don't know anything about what was inscribed on it. We don't know if the angels were on the sides of the box or if they stretched their wings over the top. Were they straight? Were they curved? Did they look like angels as we think of them? Were they lions? We don't know exactly. So we don't even know exactly what the thing looked like, other than it looked like a bark shrine. We do know from the dimensions and the way it's carried with staves. And they said it's carried with staves so because men could not touch it. But you see all kinds of inscriptions of Egyptian priests carrying bark shrines on staves over their shoulders. And so
it was deified, basically, is what you're saying. It was deified.
Yeah. And according to the Hebrew scripture, the Old Testament, it says, and Moses gathered all the people in the tabernacle, and they put the Ark of the Covenant there, and God descended like a cloud from the sky, and the whole people saw it, and it descended and settled on the Ark, and there the presence of the Lord dwelt. And what's very interesting, too, by the way, as a side note, the presence that descended is referred to as the Shekinah in the Hebrew Scripture. And the Shekinah is a strictly female genderic word. Shekinah meant the female presence of God. As a matter of fact, making a very quick modern reference to the word Shekinah, Leonard Nimoy, who played Spock in Star Trek, the other day, he had done a book of his own photography on the female form, and he called it Shekinah. Because the Hebrew word, and he was very Jewish. He was Jewish.
Yeah.
And so he used the Hebrew word for female form, and that was Shekinah. So the Shekinah was what dwelt in the ark, according to the faith story. But was it a piece of technology? That is highly speculative. All that is me going, you remember when Moses used that staff and spread it over the water? I'll bet you that was like Doctor Who's little time traveling pen. And that's what it's speculation. You don't know that. You think it's the amazing danger for anybody listening to this and anybody who loves these theories and is into this. I'm into this stuff. I enjoy it. You have to, for a minute, step outside the box of speculation and say, what proof do we have of that? That is somebody's idea, somebody's notion, somebody's. Is it a theory? No, it's a hypothesis, maybe. Or is it a notion and an idea? I can say that the Ark of the Covenant, was a UFO. It was a small UFO. But what do I do to prove my hypothesis? You can call anything you want, But and somebody out there is going to, I read this paper, this article by this guy who said he built one and it was a transformer and it was, did he do anything different than the biblical instruction? And does the biblical instruction say a box that is X number of inches or cubits wide by X number of inches long and by this deep with a lid on it with angels on it, overlaid with gold, what's the technology there?
Right.
Were there diagrams in the Old Testament? Were there technical schematics? No. It gives you a basic description of the thing, and it looks exactly like Egyptian bark shrine, which is thousands of those. And so I rather doubt. Now, you did ask about Moses perhaps communing, and I know we have very little time left here, but it's a very interesting story where Moses had his encounter with the burning bush, and this is where God spoke to him. Now, remember, he was the only guy there. He was the only guy who wrote it down. So you can accept by faith that it was absolute 100% true. This was God speaking to Moses. Or you can step outside the box and say, how do we know that really happened? How do we know Moses didn't just make that shit up? Pardon me, sorry.
I totally hear you.
God more in the vernacular on this, but there's an interesting story. The I am God, he said, whom shall I say sent me? And God said out of the bush, you tell them I am sent you. I am that I am. And we always mispronounce that phraseology. We say, I am that I am is God. He said, I am that I am, that I am that they speak of. That's me. is what he's saying. And what's very interesting is the term I am is actually derived from an ancient Mesopotamian wordplay for the name of Enki. That's all I can tell you without getting into an hour-long discussion of him.
Yeah, we can branch off and go all over the place here.
So in essence, with that passage, whom shall I say sent me? God said, I am sent you. You tell them I am that Enki they speak of. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
Wow.
We don't know what the connotation is. We don't know if he's saying I am Enki or if he's saying, you know, that Enki that they talk of, that's not true. It's really me, God, I am. So we don't know what the connotation is, but that's what's said in that passage. And that's mind-blowing.
That is. Can you, in the few minutes we have left, can you describe if any influence the Nephilim may have today? Is there any Nephilim? You get into a whole chapter about, it's called the alien influence. We don't have time to get into that right now.
Right.
Obviously, the Anunnaki were aliens, according to everybody, from Sitchin to a number of other authors, but what do you think could be a reference that we could see today that may be a Nephilim?
The closest you can come, and there's no way on this planet to prove this. The closest you can come is just by making comparison and saying, and compare them to the ancient stories, and say, are Nephilim the ones that are? If they indeed, the watchers came down and intermingled, the sons of the Elohim intermingled with humans, does this have anything at all to do with alien abduction? Does this have anything at all to do with impregnation? I know that there are a lot of even theological scholars who will make a comparison saying that the demonic is somehow related to the alien. And you got good people in these studies that will say that. So the big question is, are the Elohim demonic, or did they become demonic? Is this who they are? And even since I've written that book, the research keeps going. And I talked about they could possibly be the demonic that we meet in paranormal circles and so on. Possibly. But we don't know this for sure. I do know that the Book of Enoch speaks of once God wiped out the Nephilim off the face of the earth with the great flood, which, by the way, folks, was the real reason behind the flood. It was to eradicate this hybrid race. The wickedness, not of man, but brought to man, was the Nephilim, the offspring. But when he wiped them out, Enoch makes mention of, and those Nephilim who died in the flood, these, they are now present in spirit form on this planet, and they are the evil that will plague mankind for the rest of time. In other words, the demonic, the evil spirits of something. Not demonic, because those are certain kinds of beings. He never calls them demons. He calls them, these will be the evil spirits and the evil that will plague man for the rest of the time. So, if I believe what Enoch writes, then yes, we are still influenced by the Nephilim today. In a spiritual sense, this could be the spiritual evil that we confront with in the paranormal, if you will, or in life in general down through history. But that is a faith story. That is a story that is firmly grounded in whether or not you accept the story is true by faith or whether it's just a tale in religious mythology. There you go. Hmm.
So there's no physical evidence that you have uncovered in your research of a current... I mean, when you say spiritual... dimensional kind of thing. That's like, you know, like you say, evil spirits and things like that. But no right. Physical, no references that you've been able to uncover.
I don't think there are any physical references or finds that are really relate to Nephilim. I would be very surprised. And the only reason I say that is there's nothing that exists that has been proven. Now, if you go to the internet, by the way, and I've had people do this. Oh, Scotty, how can you believe that? There's pictures all over the internet of these archaeologists digging up 30-foot-tall skeletons and things.
Yeah.
And I like to tell them, look, I've been in advertising since the late 70s and when I was a kid. And I have been if I do say so myself, pardon the braggadocious sound of this, I'm a Photoshop expert. I've been working on Photoshop since 1989.
I was just going to mention Photoshop, yeah.
If I could not make reptilian eyes on President Jimmy Carter or make a couple of archaeologists look like they're digging up a 30-foot skeleton, I am not worth my salt as a Photoshop guru. And so there is not a single one. As a matter of fact, there was a contest that was put out. I believe it was by Adobe a few years ago that it dealt with making giant skeletons. And that's why you saw so many of them pop up all of a sudden, because everybody was putting their hand to it. Some of them are pretty stupid looking. Other ones you go, wow, that's pretty good. But as a designer, I can blow that picture up and I can tell you exactly. If I saw the original, I could say, hey, I can see exactly the earmarks of editing. So.
Exactly. One last quick question, and I know I'm going to have to keep you to a few minutes on this one. If there isn't any reference to Nephilim, how about the Watchers? The Watchers who are referenced in regards to the Nephilim.
You see them coming up all over in Scripture and in extra-biblical books. As a matter of fact, it was the book of Daniel talks about when Nebuchadnezzar, the king, went mad for 7 years. He talks about the Watchers appeared to him and told him what was going to happen. That's when Nebuchadnezzar goes mad, the king of Babylon. And then he comes out of that praising and extolling the Most High God. And so you've got references like that. The Watchers nowadays, the references to the Watchers that I have seen nowadays, nothing to me other than people saying, I had a visitation from the Watchers, or here is my theory about the Watchers today. There's no solid evidence of that. The closest you get are stories. And folks, this is what you've got to do. When you approach any of this stuff, be intrigued by it. But for God's sake, put on your thinking caps and say, oh, I read this story or I read this article. That's really cool. But then you have to question, this is somebody's experience. This is somebody's version of an account, or this is somebody's theory, or this is I got to tell you, folks, if there was proof that the Nephilim existed and are interacting in the world today, we'd know it. We wouldn't just think it happened. We'd know it. And that's the problem with this, is that there's no way to know for sure. Now, you could talk to somebody who's had that experience, and they will tell you, this is what happened to me. Listen to me. Look into my eyes. This is my experience. And I say, that is great, and I believe that you believe in your experience. The problem is, just like with Moses, look at the people that were around him at the time. Why do you think they kept rebelling or kept, you know, having problems with Moses? They weren't the ones who had the burning bush experience. It was one guy. This is what God told me to do. And I mean, what would you say if some guy, you know, what's your heritage, Cliff? British heritage.
What if some
British German guy came over to the United States and started preaching to all the British German people of British German heritage and say, we need to separate and go back to our roots. We need to leave the slavery of being enslaved to this new land to move to our own island. Follow me. And let's say these people follow him. What if they started questioning his authority? Hey, it's nothing to eat out here. Why'd you lead us here? Or there's nothing to drink. Or, hey, who are you really? What was this experience you had? I saw God. And God told me to do. And you say, okay. And some people, I think your numbers by then would be quite dwindled down to the gullible saps that you fall for a story like that. Now, the question is, did he really see God, and did God really tell him to do that? Well, according to perhaps, depends on what religion you're part of or what denomination you're part of, you would say, God doesn't do that. But what if you have a belief in God but no real attachment to a denomination? Say, maybe that is who God really is. And so, folks, put on your thinking caps about all of this stuff about Nephilim. It's not that I'm saying they aren't true and that it didn't happen, but I'm saying examine things that you choose to believe about them, because you've got to ask yourself, am I just believing a story by faith, if you will, or am I believing a story because I know something is true about it? Or it just sounds true. Well, God, that really feels right. Feelings isn't what it's about. It's whether or not you can ask the questions and make cognitive choices of what you want to believe based on what's there. And generally, I got to tell you, if something's true, it doesn't require belief. Belief is what we give to a faith, or we give to a religion, or we give to something. I believe, you know, that I believe that there is life out in the galaxy that's more advanced than us. That's a belief. That's not a solid fact. I don't know that for a fact. I can say I believe that because of this, and this, but you cannot say emphatically, I know it exists. You can say, I believe it does. Unless you have personally been visited by one, and you say, I know I'm sane, I know this happened to me, and this happened. I got to tell you, Cliff, I've had supernatural experiences that have happened to me here and in Egypt. And if I share those stories, people think I could be a little wacky. But you know what? I know my own sanity. I know my own sanity, and I know what I experienced. So that's a personal anecdotal experience that I cannot share with anybody and think that they would believe it happened, other than to say, well, I think you're credible, so I'll at least have to admit that you believe it was true. And so there you go.
Fantastic. My guest has been Scott Allen Roberts. The book, The Rise and Fall of the Nephilim, The Untold Story of Fallen Angels, Giants on the Earth, and Their Extraterrestrial Origin. Been a great hour. I do want to ask you, you have a new book that's coming out called Exodus Reality, where you actually follow the path of Moses. We're going to have you back on the program to discuss that. I guess that's coming out this month, correct?
Actually, it came out October of 2013, so it's been out for a little over a year.
Okay.
The Exodus Reality, I co-authored that with Dr. John Ward, and that will be coming. That's already out, and you can pick that up anywhere. It's where John and I have our two different theories on who we believe the actual historical Moses was, and we go into history and archaeology to establish this. And it's a fun book. It's filled with photos. We've got over 100 photos in the book, and about 16 pages of images, full color. And this travel research trip that we took, really investigating this. And John lives there. He lives in Luxor, Egypt. He's a British archaeologist.
He does live there.
He knows the lay of the land. And if I can I plug something here real quick?
Oh, please do. Yeah, I was just going to ask you. We always ask our authors to tell us where they're going to be, what they're up to, and any website references. Go ahead.
Well, if you want to know more about what we're up to, go to ExodusReality.com. It's the same as the book title. And don't go to Exodus Realty. You'll get to a real estate site, and that's not where you want to be. ExodusReality.com. We have trips that we take to Egypt. We're taking 15 people. We've got 12 of those seats left open right now because we just started putting it out there. But we're going to Ireland, and we're taking a trip on June 12th to the 23rd to Ireland with John Ward, me, Micah Hanks from the Grailian Report, Barry Fitzgerald, formerly of Ghost Hunters International, and James Swagger, another Irishman that is into the megalithic sites. We're doing a megalithic tours of Northern Ireland and sacred places, or the thin places of Ireland, as they call it. And that's coming up in June. We've got tickets on sale for that. We've got the Paradigm Symposium we do every year, the first weekend in October. And that's coming up. You can go to ParadigmSymposium.com.
Great. Hey, wonderful having you on the program. We'll have to have you back on to talk about Exodus Reality. That sounds like an amazing book. Moses has been a very interesting figure in my life, for not only religiously, but just his work and the fables and things like that. So definitely we'll have you on again.
Followed Moses since I was a kid. For some reason, he was always somebody that was something, meant something to me. I did a comic book when I was 14 years old of Moses. And I was given a scholarship to a Christian high school as a result of that. And that's so. And I've written papers on it all down through the years, and then it culminated in this book. It was something I had to write.
Fantastic. Well, again, thank you, and we'll get back, have you back on the program. Thanks again.
Thanks, Cliff. I sure appreciate it.
Okay. That's our program for the day. And as a reminder, we will have notes from our discussion with Scott Allen Roberts, the book, The Rise and the Fall of Nephilim. He's got some amazing photographs of Nephilim references and biblical locations that I think you'll find interesting. So go to Earth Ancients Facebook, Startling New Discoveries from Our Planet's Distant Past. We'll see you next time.